Naturally, she wouldn't think of laying a hand on the bar salata. But when she had brought enough disorder to Piazza dei Martiri, she moved on to the kingdom of the Carracci family, the old grocery, and installed herself there. She made Stefano keep Alfonso at home because he had to study for his makeup exams, and urged Pinuccia to go out more and more often with her mother, to poke into the shop in Piazza dei Martiri. So, little by little, she reorganized the two adjacent spaces in the old neighborhood to make the work easier and more efficient. In a short time, she demonstrated that both Maria and Pinuccia were substantially superfluous. She gave Ada a bigger job and got Stefano to increase her pay. When, in the late afternoon, I returned from the sea garden and delivered the girls to the stationer, I almost always stopped at the grocery to see how Lila was doing, if her stomach had started to swell. She was nervous, and her complexion wasn't good. To cautious questions about her pregnancy, she either didn't respond or dragged me outside the store and said nonsensical things like, "I don't want to talk about it. It's a disease. I have an emptiness inside me that weighs me down." Then she started to tell me about the new grocery and the old one, and Piazza dei Martiri, with her usual exhilarating delivery, just to make me believe that these were places where marvelous things were happening, and I, poor me, was missing them. But by now I knew her tricks. I listened, but didn't believe her, although I always ended up hypnotized by the energy with which she played both servant and mistress. Lila was able to talk to me, talk to the customers, talk to Ada, all at the same time, while continuing to unwrap, cut, weigh, take money, and give change. She erased herself in the words and gestures. She became exhausted. She seemed truly engaged in an unrelenting struggle to forget the weight of what she still described incongruously as an emptiness inside. What impressed me most, though, was her casual behavior with money. She went to the cash register and took what she wanted. Money for her was that drawer, the treasure chest of childhood that opened and offered its wealth. In the rare case that the money in the drawer wasn't enough, she had only to glance at Stefano. He, who seemed to have reacquired the generous solicitude of their engagement, pulled up his smock, dug in the back pocket of his pants, took out a fat wallet, and asked, "How much do you need?" Lila made a sign with her fingers. Her husband reached out his right arm with the fist closed. She extended her long, thin hand. Ada, behind the counter, looked at her the way she looked at the movie stars in the pages of magazines. I imagine that in that period, Antonio's sister felt as if she were living in a fairy tale. Her eyes sparkled when Lila opened the drawer and gave her money. She handed it out freely as soon as her husband turned his back. She gave Ada money for Antonio, who was going into the army. She gave money to Pasquale, who urgently needed 3 teeth extracted. In early September, she took me aside, too, and asked if I needed money for books. What books? The ones for school, but also the ones not for school. I told her that Maestra Oliviero was still not out of the hospital, that I didn't know if she would help me get the textbooks as usual. And here already Lila wanted to stick the money in my pocket. I withdrew. I refused. I didn't want to seem a kind of poor relative forced to ask for money. I told her I had to wait till school started. I told her that the stationer had extended the sea garden job until mid-September. I told her that I would therefore earn more than expected and would manage by myself. She was sorry, She insisted that I come to her if the teacher couldn't help me out. It wasn't just me. Certainly all of us, faced with that generosity of hers, had some difficulties. Pasquale, for example, didn't want to accept the money for the dentist. He felt humiliated, and finally took it only because his face was disfigured, his eye was inflamed, and the lettuce compresses were of no use. Antonio, too, was offended, to the point where to take money that our friend gave Ada in addition to her regular pay, he had to be persuaded that it was making up for the disgraceful pay that Stefano had given her before. We had never had a lot of money, and we attached great importance even to 10 lire. If we found a coin on the street, it was a celebration. So it seemed to us a mortal sin that Lila handed out money as if it were a worthless metal, waste paper. She did it silently, with an imperious gesture resembling those with which, as a child, she had organized games, assigned parts. Afterward, she talked about other things, as if that moment hadn't existed. On the other hand, Pasquale said to me one evening in his obscure way, "Mortadella sells, so do shoes, and Lina has always been our friend. She's on our side, our ally, our companion. She's rich now, but by her own merit." Yes, by her own merit, because the money didn't come to her from the fact that she is Signora Caracci, the future mother of the grocer's children, but because it's she who invented Cerullo shoes. And even if no one seemed to remember that now, we, her friends, remembered. All true. How many things Lila had made happen in the space of a few years. And yet now that we were 17, the substance of time no longer seemed fluid, but had assumed a glue-like consistency and churned around us like a yellow cream in a confectioner's machine. Lila herself confirmed this bitterly when, one Sunday, when the sea was smooth and the sky white, she appeared, to my surprise, at the sea garden around 3 in the afternoon, by herself. A truly unusual event. She had taken the subway, a couple of buses, and now was here, in a bathing suit, with a greenish complexion and an outbreak of pimples on her forehead. 17 years of shit, she said in dialect, with apparent cheer, her eyes full of sarcasm. She had quarreled with Stefano. In the daily exchanges with the Solaras, the truth came out about the management of the store and Piazza dei Martiri. Michele had tried to insist on Giliola, had harshly threatened Reno, who supported Pinuccia, had finally launched into a tense negotiation with Stefano, in which they had come close to blows. And in the end, what happened? Neither winners nor losers, it seemed. Giliola and Pinuccia would manage the store together, provided that Stefano reconsider an old decision. What? I asked. See if you can guess. I couldn't guess. Michele had asked Stefano, in his teasing tone of voice, to concede on the photograph of Lila in her wedding dress. And this time her husband had done so. Really? Really? I told you, you just had to wait. They're going to display me in the shop. In the end, I've won the bet. Not you. Start studying. This year, you'll have to get top marks. Here, she changed her tone, became serious. She said that she hadn't come because of the photograph, since she had known for a long time that as far as that shit was concerned, she was merchandise to barter. She had come because of the pregnancy. She talked about it for a long time, nervously, as if it were something to be crushed in a mortar, and she did it with cold firmness. It has no meaning, she said, not concealing her anguish. Men insert their thingy in you, and you become a box of flesh with a living doll inside. I've got it. It's here, and it's repulsive to me. I throw up continuously. It's my very stomach that can't bear it. I know I'm supposed to think beautiful things. I know I have to resign myself, but I can't do it. I see no reason for resignation and no beauty. Besides the fact, she added, that I feel incapable of dealing with children. You, yes, you are. Just look how you take care of the stationer's children. Not me. I wasn't born with that gift. These words hurt me. What could I say? You don't know if you have a gift or not. You have to try. I sought to reassure her, and pointed to the daughters of the stationer who were playing a little distance away. Sit with them for a while. Talk to them. She laughed. She said maliciously that I had learned to use the sentimental voice of our mothers. But then, uneasily, she ventured to say a few words to the girls, retreated, began talking to me again. I equivocated, pressed her, urged her to take care of Linda, the smallest of the stationer's daughters. I said to her, "Go on, let her play her favorite game, drinking from the fountain next to the bar, or spraying the water by putting your thumb over it." She led Linda away unwillingly, holding her hand. Time passed, and they didn't come back. I called the other two girls and went to see what was happening. Everything was fine. Leela had been happily made a prisoner by Linda. She held the child suspended over the jet, letting her drink or spray water. They were both laughing, and their laughter sounded like cries of joy. I was relieved. I left Linda's sisters with her, too, and went to sit at the bar, in a place where I could keep an eye on all four and also read. She'll become that, I thought, looking at her. What seemed insupportable before is cheering her up now. Maybe I should tell her that things without meaning are the most beautiful ones. It's a good sentence. She'll like it. Lucky her. She's got everything that counts. For a while, I tried to follow, line by line, the arguments of Rousseau. Then I looked up. I saw that something was wrong. Shouts. Maybe Linda had leaned over too far. Maybe one of her sisters had given her a shove. Certainly, she had escaped Leela's grasp and had hit her chin on the edge of the basin. I ran over in fear. Leela, as soon as she saw me, cried immediately, in a childish voice that I had never heard from her, not even when she was a child. It was her sister who made her fall, not me. She was holding Linda, who was bleeding, screaming, crying, as her sisters looked elsewhere with small nervous movements and tight smiles, as if the thing had nothing to do with them, as if they couldn't hear, couldn't see. I tore the child from Leela's arms and tilted her toward the jet of water, washing her face with resentful hands. There was a horizontal cut under her chin. I'll lose the money from the stationer, I thought. My mother will be angry. Meanwhile, I ran for the attendant, who somehow cajoled Linda into calming down, surprised her with an inundation of rubbing alcohol, making her shriek again, then stuck a gauze bandage on her chin and went back to soothing her. Nothing serious, in other words. I bought ice cream for the three girls and went back to the concrete platform. Leela had left. 25. The stationer didn't seem especially upset by Linda's wound, but when I asked if I should come the next day at the usual time to pick up the girls, she said that her daughters had had too much swimming that summer, and there was no need for me anymore. I didn't tell Leela that I had lost my job. She, on the other hand, never asked me how things had turned out. She didn't even ask about Linda and her cut. When I saw her again, she was extremely busy with the opening of the new grocery store and gave me the impression of an athlete in training, jumping rope more and more frantically. She dragged me to the printer, from whom she had ordered a large number of flyers announcing the opening of the new store. She wanted me to go to the priest to set a time to come by for the blessing of the place and the stock. She announced that she had hired Carmela Peluso at a salary a lot higher than what she was making at the Notions store. But first of all, she told me that in everything, truly everything, she was waging a serious war against her husband, Pinucha, her mother-in-law, her brother Reno. She didn't seem especially aggressive, however. She spoke in a low voice, in dialect, doing a thousand other things that seemed more important than what she was saying. She enumerated the wrongs that her relatives, by marriage and by birth, had done and were doing to her. "They have placated Michele," she said, "just as they placated Marcello. They used me. To them, I'm not a person, but a thing. Let's give him Leela. Let's stick her on a wall since she's a zero, an absolute zero." As she spoke, her eyes shone, full of movement, within dark circles. Her skin was stretched over the cheekbones. Her teeth flashed white in quick, nervous smiles. But she didn't convince me. It seemed to me that behind that raucous activity was a person who was exhausted and looking for a way out. "What do you intend to do?" I asked. "Nothing. All I know is they'll have to kill me to do what they want with my photograph." "Forget it, Leela. Ultimately, it's a nice thing. Think about it. They only put actresses on billboards." "And am I an actress?" "No." "So? If my husband has decided to sell himself to the Saladas, do you think he can sell me as well?" I tried to soothe her. I was afraid that Stefano would lose patience and hit her. I said so. She started laughing. Since she'd been pregnant, her husband hadn't dared to give her even a slap. But now, just as she uttered that remark, the suspicion dawned on me that the photograph was an excuse, that really she wanted to infuriate all of them, to be massacred by Stefano, by the Saladas, by Reno, provoke them to the point where their blows would help her to crush the impatience, the pain, the living thing she had in her belly. My hypothesis found support the night the grocery opened. She seemed to be wearing her shabbiest clothes. In front of everyone, she treated her husband like a servant. She sent away the priest she had had me call on before he could bless the store, contemptuously sticking some money in his hand. She went on to slice prosciutto and stuffed sandwiches, handing them out free to anyone, along with a glass of wine. And this last move was so successful that the store had scarcely opened when it was jammed with customers. She and Carmela were besieged, and Stefano, who was elegantly dressed, had to help them deal with the situation, as he was, without an apron, so that his good clothes got all greasy. When they came home, exhausted, her husband made a scene, and Leela did her best to provoke his fury. She shouted that if he wanted someone who obeyed, and that's all, he was out of luck. She was not his mother or his sister. She would always make life difficult for him. And she started with the Saladas, with the business of the photograph, insulting him grossly. First, he let her have her say. Then he responded with even worse insults. But he didn't beat her. When, the next day, she told me what had happened, I said that although Stefano had his faults, certainly he loved her. She denied it. "He understands only this," she replied, rubbing together thumb and index finger. And in fact, the grocery was already popular throughout the new neighborhood, and was crowded from the moment it opened. "The cash drawer is already full, thanks to me. I bring him wealth, a son. What more does he want?" "What more do you want?" I asked, with a stab of rage that surprised me, and immediately I smiled, hoping she hadn't noticed. I remember that she looked bewildered. She touched her forehead with her fingers. Maybe she didn't even know what she wanted. She felt only that she couldn't find peace. As the other opening, that of the shop on Piazza dei Martiri, approached, she became unbearable. But maybe that adjective is excessive. Let's say that she poured out onto all of us, even me, the confusion that she felt inside. On the one hand, she made Stefano's life hell. She squabbled with her mother-in-law and her sister-in-law. She went to Reno and quarreled with him in front of the workers and Fernando, who, more hunched than usual, labored over his bench, pretending not to hear. On the other, she herself perceived that she was spinning around in her unhappiness, unresigned, and at times I caught her in the new grocery store, in a rare moment when it was empty, or she wasn't dealing with suppliers, with a vacant look, one hand on her forehead, in her hair, as if to stanch a wound, and the expression of someone who was trying to catch her breath. One afternoon I was at home. It was still very hot, although it was the end of September. School was about to begin. I felt at the mercy of the days. My mother reproached me for wasting time. Nino, who knows where he was, in England, or in that mysterious space that was the university. I no longer had Antonio, or even the hope of getting back together with him. He had left, along with Enzo Scano, for his military service, saying goodbye to everyone except me. I heard someone calling me from the street. It was Leela. Her eyes were shining, as if she had a fever, and she said she had found a solution. Solution to what? The photograph. If they want to display it, they have to do it the way I say. And what do you say? She didn't tell me. Maybe at that moment it wasn't clear to her. But I knew what sort of person she was, and I recognized in her face the expression she got when, from the dark depths of herself, a signal arrived that fired her brain. She asked me to go with her that evening to Piazza dei Martiri. There we would find the Solaras, Giliola, Pinuccia, her brother. She wanted me to help her, support her, and I realized that what she had in mind would ferry her beyond her permanent war, a violent but conclusive outlet for the accumulated tensions, or a way of freeing her head, her body, from pent-up energies. "All right," I said, "but promise not to be crazy." "Yes." After the stores closed, she and Stefano came to get me in the car. From the few words they exchanged, I understood that not even her husband knew what she had in mind, and that this time my presence, rather than reassuring him, alarmed him. Leela had finally appeared to be accommodating. She had told him that, if there was no possibility of abandoning the photograph, she wanted at least to have her say on how it was displayed. "A question of frame, wall, lighting?" he had asked. "I have to see."
"But then that's it, Lena."
"Yes, that's it."
It was a beautiful warm evening, The brilliant lights of the shop's interior spread their glow into the square. The gigantic image of Leela in her wedding dress could be seen at a distance, leaning against the center wall. Stefano parked. We went in, making our way among the boxes of shoes, piled up haphazardly, cans of paint, ladders. Marcello, Rino, Giliola, and Pinuccia were visibly irritated. For varying reasons, they had no wish to submit yet again to Leela's caprices. The only one who greeted us cordially was Michele, who turned to my friend with a mocking laugh. "Lovely signora. Will you let us know, at last, what you have in mind, or do you just want to ruin the evening?" Leela looked at the panel leaning against the wall, asked them to lay it on the floor. Marcello said cautiously, with the dark timidity that he always showed toward Leela, "What for?"
"I'll show you."
Rino interrupted. "Don't be an idiot, Leela. You know how much this thing cost. If you ruin it, you're in trouble." The Solaras laid the image on the floor. Leela looked around, with her brow furrowed, her eyes narrowed. She was looking for something that she knew was there, that perhaps she had bought herself. In a corner, she spied a roll of black paper, and she took a pair of big scissors and a box of drawing pins from a shelf. Then, with that expression of extreme concentration which enabled her to isolate herself from everything around her, she went back to the panel. Before our astonished and, in the cases of some, openly hostile eyes, she cut strips of black paper with the manual precision she had always possessed and pinned them here and there to the photograph, asking for my help with slight gestures or quick glances. I joined in with the devotion that I had felt ever since we were children. Those moments were thrilling. It was a pleasure to be beside her, slipping inside her intentions, to the point of anticipating her. I felt that she was seeing something that wasn't there, and that she was struggling to make us see it too. I was suddenly happy, feeling the intensity that invested her, that flowed through her fingers as they grasped the scissors, as they pinned the black paper. Finally, she tried to lift the canvas, as if she were alone in that space, but she couldn't. Marcello readily intervened. I intervened. We leaned it against the wall. Then we all backed up toward the door, some sneering, some grim, some appalled. The body of the bride Leela appeared cruelly shredded. Much of the head had disappeared, as had the stomach. There remained an eye, the hand on which the chin rested, the brilliant stain of the mouth, the diagonal stripe of the bust, the line of the crossed legs, the shoes. Giliola began, scarcely containing her rage. "I cannot put a thing like that in my shop." "I agree," Pinuccia exploded. "We have to sell here, and with that grotesque thing, people will run away. Rino, say something to your sister, please." Rino pretended to ignore her, but he turned to Stefano, as if his brother-in-law were to blame for what was happening. "I told you. You can't reason with her. You have to say yes, no, and that's it. Or you see what happens? It's a waste of time." Stefano didn't answer. He stared at the panel leaning against the wall, and it was evident that he was looking for a way out. He asked me, "What do you think, Lenu?" I said in Italian, "To me it seems very beautiful. Of course, I wouldn't want it in the neighborhood. That's not the right place for it. But here, it's something else. It will attract attention. It will please. In Confidenze, just last week, I saw that in Rossano Brazzi's house, there is a painting like this." Hearing that, Giliola got even angrier. What do you mean, that Rossano Brazzi knows what's what? That you two know everything, and Pinuccia and I don't?
At that point, I felt the danger. I had only to glance at Leela to realize that, if when we arrived at the shop she had really felt willing to give in should the attempt prove fruitless, now that the attempt had been made and had produced that image of disfigurement, she wouldn't yield an inch. Those minutes of work on the picture had broken ties. At that moment, she was overwhelmed by an exaggerated sense of herself, and it would take time for her to retreat into the dimension of the grocer's wife. She wouldn't accept a sigh of dissent. In fact, while Giliola was speaking, she was already muttering, "Like this, or not at all." And she wanted to quarrel. She wanted to break, shatter. She would have happily hurled herself at Giliola with the scissors. I hoped for a word of support from Marcello, but Marcello remained silent, head down. I understood that his residual feelings for Leela were vanishing at that moment. His old, depressed passion couldn't carry them forward any longer. It was his brother who broke in, lashing Giliola, his fiancée, in his most aggressive tone. "Shut up," he told her. And as soon as she tried to protest, he became threatening, without even looking at her, staring rather at the panel. "Shut up, Giglio." Then he turned to Leela. "I like it, Signor. You've erased yourself deliberately, and I see why. To show the thigh. To show how well a woman's thigh goes with those shoes. Excellent. You're a pain in the ass, but when you do a thing, you do it right." Silence. With her fingertips, Giliola dried silent tears that she couldn't hold back. Pinuccia stared at Rino, who stared at her brother, as if she wanted to say to them, "Speak. Defend me. Don't let that bitch walk all over me." Stefano instead murmured softly, "Yes, it convinces me too." And Leela said suddenly, "It's not finished." "What do you still have to do?" Pinuccia shot back. "I have to add a little color."
"Color?"
Marcello mumbled, even more disoriented.
"We're supposed to open in 3 days.
Michele laughed. "If we have to wait another little bit, we'll wait. Get to work, Signor. Do what you like." The masterful tone of one who makes and unmakes as he wishes, Stefano didn't like.
"There's the new grocery," he said,
to let it be understood that he needed his wife there.
"Figure it out," Michele answered. "We have more interesting things to do here."
26. We spent the last days of September shut up in the shop, the two of us and three workmen. They were magnificent hours of play, of invention, of freedom, such as we hadn't experienced together perhaps since childhood. Leela drew me into her frenzy. We bought paste, paint, brushes. With extreme precision, she was demanding, we attached the black paper cutouts. We traced red or blue borders between the remains of the photograph and the dark clouds that were devouring it. Leela had always been good with lines and colors, but here she did something more. Though I wouldn't have been able to say what it was. Hour after hour, it engulfed me. For a while, it seemed to me that she had fashioned that occasion to bring to an effective end the years that had begun with the designs for the shoes, when she was still the girl, Lina Cerullo. And I still think that much of the pleasure of those days was derived from the resetting of the conditions of her, or our, life, from the capacity we had
to lift ourselves above ourselves, to isolate ourselves in the pure and simple fulfillment of that sort of visual synthesis. We forgot about Antonio, Nino, Stefano, the Salatas, my problems with school, her pregnancy, the tensions between us. We suspended time. We isolated space. There remained only the play of glue, scissors, paper, paint, the play of shared creation. But there was something else. I was soon reminded of the word Michele had used, erase. Likely, yes, very likely, the black stripes did set the shoes apart and make them more visible. Young Salata wasn't stupid. He knew how to look. But at times, and with growing intensity, I felt that that wasn't the true goal of our pasting and painting. Leela was happy, and she was drawing me deeper and deeper into her fierce happiness, because she had suddenly found, perhaps without even realizing it, an opportunity that allowed her to portray the fury she had directed against herself, the insurgence, perhaps for the first time in her life, of the need, and here the verb used by Michele was appropriate, to erase herself. Today, in the light of many subsequent events, I'm quite sure that that is really what happened. With the black paper, with the green and purple circles that Leela drew around certain parts of her body, with the blood-red lines with which she sliced and said she was slicing it, she contemplated her own self-destruction in an image, presented to the eyes of all in the space bought by the Salatas to display and sell her shoes. It's likely that it was she who provoked in me that impression, who motivated it. While we worked, she began to talk about when she had begun to realize that she was now Signora Caracci. At first, I didn't really understand what she was saying. Her observations seemed to me banal. When, as girls, of course, we were in love, we would try out the sound of our name joined to the last name of the beloved. I, for example, still have a notebook from my first year of high school in which I practiced signing myself Elena Saratore. And I clearly remember how I would very faintly whisper that name. But it wasn't what Leela meant. I soon realized that she was confessing exactly the opposite. A game like mine had never occurred to her. Nor, she said, had the formula of her new designation at first made much of an impression. Raffaella Cerullo Caracci. Nothing exciting. Nothing serious. In the beginning, that Caracci had been no more absorbing than an exercise in logical analysis, of the sort that Maestra Oliviero had hammered into us in elementary school. What was it? An indirect object of place? Did it mean that she now lived not with her parents, but with Stefano? Did it mean that the new house where she was going to live would have on the door a brass plate that said Caracci? Did it mean that if I were to write to her, I would no longer address the letter to Raffaella Cerullo, but to Raffaella Caracci? Did it mean that in everyday use, Cerullo would soon disappear from Raffaella Cerullo Caracci? And that she herself would define herself and sign only as Raffaella Caracci? And that her children would have to make an effort to recall their mother's surname, and that her grandchildren would be completely ignorant of their grandmother's surname? Yes, a custom. Everything according to the rules, then. But Leela, as usual, hadn't stopped there. She had soon gone further. As we worked with brushes and paints, she told me that she had begun to see in that formula an indirect object of place to which, as if Cerullo Caracci somehow indicated that Cerullo goes toward Caracci,
falls into it, is sucked up by it, is dissolved in it. And from the abrupt assignment of the role of speechmaker at her wedding to Silvio Solara, from the entrance into the restaurant of Marcello Solara, wearing on his feet, no less, the shoes that Stefano had led her to believe he considered a sacred relic, from her honeymoon and the beatings up until that installation, in the void that she felt inside, the living thing determined by Stefano, she had been increasingly oppressed by an unbearable sensation, a force pushing down harder and harder, crushing her. That impression had been getting stronger, had prevailed. Raffaella Cerullo, overpowered, had lost her shape and had dissolved inside the outlines of Stefano, becoming a subsidiary emanation of him, Signora Caracci. It was then that I began to see in the panel the traces of what she was saying. "It's a thing that's still going on," she said in a whisper. And meanwhile, we pasted paper, laid on color. But what were we really doing? What was I helping her do? The workmen, in great bewilderment, attached the panel to the wall. We were sad, but we didn't say so. The game was over. We cleaned the shop thoroughly. Lila changed her mind once again about the position of a sofa, of an ottoman. Finally, we withdrew together to the door and contemplated our work. She burst out laughing as I had never heard her laugh, a free, self-mocking laugh. I, on the other hand, was so enthralled by the upper part of the panel, where Lila's head no longer was, that I couldn't take in the whole. All you could see, at the top, was a very vivid eye, encircled by midnight blue and red. 27. The day of the opening, Lila arrived in Piazza dei Martiri, sitting in the convertible next to her husband. When she got out, I saw in her the uncertain gaze of someone who is afraid something bad is going to happen. The overexcitement of the days of the panel had dissipated. She had again taken on the sickly look of a woman who is unwillingly pregnant. Yet she was carefully dressed. She seemed to have stepped out of a fashion magazine. She immediately left Stefano and dragged me off to look at the shop windows of Via dei Mille. We walked for a while. She was tense. She kept asking me if anything was out of place. "Do you remember?" she said suddenly. "The girl dressed all in green, the one with the derby?" I remembered. I remembered the uneasiness we had felt when we saw her on that same street years before, and the fight between our boys and the local boys, and the intervention of the Solaras, and Michele with the iron bar, and the fear. I realized that she wanted to hear something soothing. I said, "It was just a matter of money, Lila. Today it's all changed. You're much prettier than the girl in green." But I thought, "It's not true. I'm lying to you." There was something malevolent in the inequality, and now I knew it. It acted in the depths. It dug deeper than money. The cash of two grocery stores, and even of the shoe factory and the shoe store, was not sufficient to hide our origin. Lila herself, even if she had taken from the cash drawer more money than she had taken, even if she had taken millions, 30, even 50, couldn't do it. I had understood this, and finally there was something that I knew better than she did. I had learned it not on those streets, but outside the school, looking at the girl who came to meet Nino. She was superior to us, just as she was, unwittingly. And this was unendurable.
We returned to the shop. The afternoon went on like a kind of marriage feast. Food, sweets, a lot of wine. All the guests in the clothes they had worn to Lila's wedding. Fernando, Nunzia, Reno, the entire Salada family, Alfonso, we girls, Ada, Carmela, and I. There was a crowd of cars haphazardly parked. There was a crowd in the shop. The clamor of voices grew louder. The entire time, Giliola and Pinuccia competed to act like the proprietor, each striving harder than the other, and both worn out by the strain. The panel with Lila's picture loomed over everything. Some paused to look at it with interest. Some gave it a skeptical glance, or even laughed. I couldn't take my eyes off it. Lila was no longer recognizable. What remained was a seductive, tremendous form, the image of a one-eyed goddess who thrust her beautifully shod feet into the center of the room. In the crush, I was amazed by Alfonso, who was lively, cheerful, elegant. I had never seen him like that, at school, or in the neighborhood, or in the grocery. And Lila herself pondered him for a long time, perplexed. I said to her, laughing, "He's not himself anymore." "What happened to him?" "I don't know." Alfonso was the true good news of that afternoon. Something that had been silent in him awakened in the brightly lit shop. It was as if he had unexpectedly discovered that this part of the city made him feel good. He became unusually active. We saw him arrange this object and that, start up conversations with the stylish people who came in out of curiosity, who examined the shoes or grabbed a pastry and a glass of vermouth. At a certain point, he joined us, and in a self-assured tone, praised effusively the work we had done on the photograph. He was in a state of such mental freedom that he overcame his timidity and said to his sister-in-law, "I've always known you were dangerous." And he kissed her on both cheeks. I stared at him perplexed. Dangerous? What had he perceived in the panel that had escaped me? Was Alfonso capable of seeing beyond appearances? Did he know how to look with imagination? Is it possible, I wondered, that his real future is not in studying, but in this affluent part of the city, where he'll be able to use the little he's learning in school? Ah, yes. He concealed inside himself another person. He was different from all the boys of the neighborhood, and mainly he was different from his brother Stefano, who, sitting on an ottoman in a corner, was silent, but ready to respond with a tranquil smile to anyone who spoke to him. Evening fell. Suddenly, a bright light flared outside. The Saladas, grandfather, father, mother, sons, rushed out to see, gripped by a noisy, familial enthusiasm. We all went out into the street. Above the windows in the entrance shone the word, Salada. Lila grimaced. She said to me, "They gave in on that, too." She pushed me reluctantly toward Reno, who seemed happiest of all, and said to him, "If the shoes are Cerullo, why is the shop Salada?" Reno took her by the arm and said in a low voice, "Lina, why do you always want to be a pain in the ass? You remember the mess you got me into in this very square? What am I supposed to do? You want another mess? Be satisfied for once. We are here, in the center of Naples, and we are the masters. Those shits who wanted to beat us up less than 3 years ago, do you see them now? They stop. They look in the windows. They go in. They take a pastry. Isn't that enough for you? Cerullo shoes, Salada shop. What do you want to see up there? Karachi?" Lila was evasive, saying to him, without aggression, I'm perfectly calm. Enough to tell you that you'd better not ask me for anything ever again.
What do you think you're doing? Do you borrow money from Signora Salata? Does Stefano borrow money from her? Are you both in debt to her, so you always say yes?
From now on, every man for himself, Reno. She abandoned us, headed straight toward Michele Salata in a playfully flirtatious way. I saw that she went off with him to the square. They walked around the stone lions. I saw that her husband followed her with his gaze. I saw that he didn't take his eyes off her all the while she and Michele walked, talking. I saw that Giliola grew furious. She whispered in Pinuccia's ear, and they both stared at her. Meanwhile, the shop emptied. Someone turned off the large, luminous sign. The square darkened for a few seconds. Then the street lamps regained their strength. Lila left Michele laughing, but as she entered the shop, her face was suddenly drained of life. She shut herself in the back room where the toilet was. Alfonso, Marcello, Pinuccia, and Giliola began to straighten up. I went to help. Lila came out of the bathroom, and Stefano, as if he had been waiting in ambush, immediately grabbed her by the arm. She wriggled free, irritated, and joined me. She was very pale. She whispered, I've had some blood. What does it mean? Is the baby dead? 28. Lila's pregnancy lasted scarcely more than 10 weeks. Then the midwife came and scraped away everything. The next day she went back to work in the new grocery with Carmen Peluso. This marked the beginning of a long period in which, sometimes gentle, sometimes fierce, she stopped running around, having apparently decided to compress her whole life into the orderliness of that space fragrant with mortar and cheese, filled with sausages, bread, mozzarella, anchovies and salt, hunks of ciccoli, sacks overflowing with dried beans, bladders stuffed with lard. This behavior was greatly appreciated in particular by Stefano's mother, Maria. As if she had recognized in her daughter-in-law something of herself, she suddenly became more affectionate and gave her some old earrings of red gold. Lila accepted them with pleasure and wore them often. For a while, her face remained pale. She had pimples on her forehead. Her eyes were sunk deep into the sockets. The skin was stretched so tight over her cheekbones that it seemed transparent. Then she revived and put even more energy into promoting the shop. Already by Christmas time, the profits had risen, and within a few months surpassed those of the grocery in the old neighborhood. Maria's appreciation grew. She went more and more often to give her daughter-in-law a hand, rather than her son, whose failed paternity, along with the pressures of business, had made him surly. Or her daughter, who had started working in the store in Piazza dei Martiri, and had strictly forbidden her mother to appear, so as not to make a bad impression with the clientele. The old Signora Caracci even took the young Signora Caracci's side when Stefano and Pinuccia blamed her for her inability, or unwillingness, to keep a baby inside her. She doesn't want children, Stefano complained. Yes, Pinuccia supported him. She wants to stay a girl. She doesn't know how to be a wife. Maria reproached them both harshly. Don't even think such things. Our Lord gives children, and our Lord takes them away. I don't want to hear that nonsense. You be quiet, her daughter cried in annoyance. You gave that bitch the earrings I liked. Their arguments, Lila's reactions, soon became neighborhood gossip, which spread, and even I heard it. But I didn't pay much attention. The school year had begun. It started right off in a way that amazed me most of all. I did well from the first days, as if, with the departure of Antonio, the disappearance of Nino, maybe even Leela's decisive commitment to managing the grocery, something in my head had relaxed. I found that I remembered with precision everything I had learned badly in my first year. I answered the teacher's questions with ready intelligence. Not only that, Professor Galliani, maybe because she had lost Nino, her most brilliant student, redoubled her interest in me and said that it would be stimulating and instructive for me to go to a march for world peace that started in Resina and continued on to Naples. I decided to have a look, partly out of curiosity, partly out of fear that Professor Galliani would be offended, and partly because the march went along the Stradone, skirting the neighborhood, and it wouldn't take much effort. But my mother wanted me to take my brothers. I argued, I protested, and was late. I arrived with them at the railway bridge, and down below saw the people marching. They occupied the whole street, preventing the cars from passing. They were normal people, and weren't really marching, but walking, carrying banners and signs. I wanted to find Professor Galliani, to be seen, and I ordered my brothers to wait on the bridge. It was a terrible idea. I couldn't find the professor, and as soon as I turned my back, they joined some other children who were throwing stones at the demonstrators and yelling insults. In a sweat, I rushed to get them and hurried them away, terrified by the idea that the far-sighted Professor Galliani had picked them out and recognized that they were my brothers. Meanwhile, the weeks passed. There were new classes and the textbooks to buy. It seemed pointless to show the list of books to my mother so that she could negotiate with my father and get money from him. I knew that there was no money. In addition, there was no news of Maestra Oliviero. Between August and September, I had gone twice to visit her in the hospital. But the first time, I had found her asleep, and the second, I discovered that she had been discharged, but had not returned home. Feeling desperate, in early November, I went to ask the neighbor about her, and learned that, because of her health, she had gone to a sister in Potenza, and who knew if she would ever return to Naples, to the neighborhood, to her job. At that point, I decided to ask Alfonso if, when his brother had bought the books for him, we could somehow arrange things so that I could use his. He was enthusiastic and proposed that we should study together, maybe at Leela's house, which, ever since she had started working at the grocery, was empty from 7 in the morning until 9 at night. We resolved to do that. But one morning, Alfonso said to me, somewhat annoyed, "Go and see Leela in the grocery today. She wants to see you." He knew why, but she had sworn him to silence, and it was impossible to get the secret out of him. In the afternoon, I went to the new grocery. Carmen, with a mixture of sadness and joy, wanted to show me a card from some city in Piedmont that Enzo, her fiancé, had sent her. Leela had also received a card from Antonio. And for a moment, I thought she had wanted me to come there just to show it to me. But she didn't show it to me, or tell me what he had written. She dragged me into the back of the shop and asked, in a tone of amusement, "You remember our bet?" I nodded yes. "You remember that you lost?" I nodded yes. "You remember that you now have to pass with the best grades?" I nodded yes. She pointed to two large packages tied up in wrapping paper. In them were the school books. 29. They were very heavy. At home, I was very excited to discover that they were